I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, as Washington debates Iran, we'll have a conversation with a young Jewish American about his travels there. But first, the headline in the News Tribune in Tacoma, Washington says it all. I-5 closures create havoc for trucking companies. A 20-mile stretch of the main artery connecting Canada, the U.S., and Mexico is closed, parts under 10 feet of water, following this week's storm and floods that killed at least 5 people in the Northwest and stranded thousands. Tens of thousands of residents in both Oregon and Washington states are still without power. Both states remain under a state of emergency, and of course that stretch of road connects Seattle with Portland, Oregon. Joining us is Regional Public Radio correspondent Tom Bancy in Olympia, Washington. Tom, let's start with that trucking. What's the situation?
Well, there are still hundreds of trucks, literally, Robin, parked on rest areas, highway shoulders, and truck stops in southwest Washington, even down to Portland, and these truckers are waiting it out. I've talked to a bunch of them about why they didn't try the detour, which is, I have to say, 400 miles, and the cost and time involved in that, they're taking their chances that the highway will reopen sooner than later. But there is a considerable amount of frustration building. As you may note, most truckers are not paid unless they're moving.
I'm not making money right now. I got stuck here, not making any money, and then Christmas is coming to buy some presents for our kids, and we're human. We get upset time to time, but it's just a matter of attitude.
If this was somebody else's fault, then I see you should get all pissed off. But this is Mother Nature, man. What you gonna do? You know what I mean? That's how I see it.
So you can hear that, Robin, people are trying to make the best of it, but that last voice was Tyrone Nelson, the trucker from New York, who also told me he's never going to come back to the Pacific Northwest in the winter again.
Well, we understand there's about 11,000 trucks that use this affected stretch of highway, and we're reading about a Seattle-based trucking company that's saying that right now they're absorbing this cost, but they may have to have some hard conversations with markets further south from them about passing that cost on.
Yeah, and the trucking companies are going to the state and asking, you know, for urgent perishable goods, can't we have a shorter detour on country roads that normally are not strong enough to handle heavy trucks, but if we could just let those perishable goods through until the weekend, perhaps, maybe that would keep the damage to a minimum. But that request hasn't worked its way all the way through yet.
Well, and we understand now that the detour, which goes across the Cascade Mountains and down central Washington to the Oregon border, pretty much doubles the 3-hour trip from Seattle to Portland.
It does. And you know, every extra day here of waiting, some of these trucks and a lot of passengers are taking that detour, deciding, you know, I can't wait forever.
Well, and what about the human factor here, the rescue operations? We know that coastal areas in both states were difficult to get to. Vernonia in Oregon was cut off by landslides. Are rescue teams getting food and basic needs to people who are cut off?
They are. We're having what is probably the largest aerial search and rescue operation in a decade in the Pacific Northwest, with aircraft from the Coast Guard. We brought in the Air Force, the Navy, the National Guard. County police helicopters are still flying. The rescue operations are starting to wind down. Some of the highways between the kind of populated inland cities of Portland and Seattle out to the scenic Oregon and Washington coast are starting to reopen. But in a few places, including the lower Chehalis River in southwest Washington, the river is still rising, and they're having to rescue new groups of people who are stranded by the rising floodwaters.
The Chehalis River has been a flooding problem for years. It's central to the flooding on the I-5 artery we've been talking about. It's under 10 feet of water there. We understand there's some political fallout from this.
Well, this has been on the radar. It's not the first time the freeway has been cut off and that artery of commerce severed. So people have been talking about, well, do we raise the highway or do we raise the dikes to keep the water away from the highway, all of which are very expensive. There's been kind of back and forth whose responsibility this is. If you're talking about the dikes, well, then maybe we could get the feds, the Army Corps of Engineers, to pay for this. But as you know, for the New Orleans situation, they're not swimming in money for that. You know, the state has a lot of congestion problems about Seattle. Is that a higher priority than the freeway in a rural area? So it's always on the list. It's been on the list for more than a decade to be fixed. But, by the time it's time to put a signature on the state budget, it's fallen off.
Well, we understand that the deputy mayor in Seattle is one of those asking that with climate change, does the city need to upgrade its drainage systems and its sewage systems? And we're just wondering, you know, we're based here in the East. We understand where you are in the Pacific Northwest. These storms are part of something called the Pineapple Express. They come through on a certain basis. But is there a sense that there's something worse about this storm?
There is. And you can't attribute a specific storm like this one directly to global warming. But we have a term that's being coined here called the New November. That is, a storm like this used to be once every 30 years, maybe 40 years, and we seem to be having them more like once every 10 years now. And one of the models for global warming suggests that we'll have actually wetter Novembers and Decembers and stormier winters here, and especially kind of these warm kind of storms that don't end up being snow in the mountains, but where all that water coming off the Pacific all runs off downhill into our low-lying valleys.
Tom Bancy is a regional correspondent for Public Radio. He's speaking to us from Olympia, Washington. Tom, thank you.
You're welcome.
President Bush called on Iran today to come clean about its nuclear activities. He says he wants details about the Iranian nuclear weapons program that ended in 2003, according to this week's National Intelligence Estimate. The report put the White House on the defensive, with President Bush continuing to say that Iran poses a serious threat to the international community. But Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad saw the report as a victory, proving that Iran only seeks civilian nuclear power. Well, as the war of words continues, a young diplomat says the U.S. is missing an opportunity. Jared Cohen is a 20-something member of the State Department's policy planning staff now. But before that, he traveled around the Middle East as a grad student doing research. He went cruising in a souped-up car in Iran, partied all night in Beirut. His book is Children of Jihad, A Young American's Travels Among the Youth of the Middle East. He also met with young members of the militant group Hezbollah at a McDonald's and visited Hamas supporters at a Palestinian refugee camp. And what his book title omits, he traveled as a young Jewish American. He joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Jared, welcome.
Thanks, Robin.
Some people would have said this was really stupid. Why did you want to do this?
Robin, on 9/11, I think in the back of my head, I had the same burning questions that a lot of other young people had, which is, you know, how is it that young people our age, just who were born in that part of the world by chance, how could they hate us so much that they would fly planes into buildings in New York and in Washington, D.C.? And I knew that that wasn't reflective of the majority. I had traveled a little bit in the region, but I wanted to go see for myself what makes my peers tick over there. So I, as you said, tested this very simple, albeit dangerous, hypothesis of what happens when a young Jewish kid from Connecticut treks around Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon.
And it was almost forced on you in one aspect. In Iran, for instance, you really wanted to talk to officials, but you had so many minders that they sort of, you know, blocked your access to some of the officials, and instead you sort of got away from them and met the kids.
I had originally gone to Iran in December of 2004 to interview members of the political opposition, reformists, well-known dissident journalists, and so forth. It's a really difficult thing to do this in Iran, especially when they find a list of individuals and groups that you want to meet with. As soon as I came into contact with young people in that country and saw a youth culture that defied every stereotype you could imagine, it became very clear to me not long after that I had actually gone to Iran to study the wrong opposition, that the much more interesting opposition in that country was the 67% of it that's under the age of 30.
As so many young people in Iran, because of their long war with Iraq and all the men who were killed. So let's start there. You were at the University of Tehran. You watched kids socializing and you just started approaching people. How did you find them?
Well, here's the interesting thing. You know, the big conclusion that I come to in Children of Jihad is that young people really aren't that different than us. In that part of the world. The only difference is in alternatives. But the reality is that young people are our best opportunity in actually bringing about reform and progress in the Middle East because they're the most impressionable, they're the most similar to us, and they're the most connected to us by virtue of the technology boom and that they were born with these technologies. Now, I found that when I would sort of get into that initial conversation by talking about music and sports and girls and, you know, technology was always a good conversation, it established a similarity across our cultures.
Well, for instance, you went to an underground party with a young man who called you and he said, "I want you to see my Iran." Tell us about the party you went to.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Young people in Iran will tell you, we're not terrorists, we're not Arab, and we do things just like all of you. 50% of the country is Persian. It does have a 3% Arab demographic, but you know, it's an ethnic mix. But they're very cognizant of the fact that they're lumped together with the rest of the Middle East. But these parties you go to, I mean, kids make alcohol in bathtubs and sinks and listen to Western music and wear Western clothes. Now, where people mistake what I'm saying is they assume that because I'm saying young people like to party in the Middle East, that means everything's going to be okay, and that means that that's going to change their political views. I by no means say that. What I'm saying is that because young people do things similarly to young people in America, there's an opening. Now, what we do with that opening is going to determine whether or not we embrace young people as a potential opportunity or mistake young people as a potential threat. But young people are there.
For instance, you tell of another scene where you had a lot of fun, apparently, in part of a lot of these places.
It was a good time.
You went out on one of these cruise nights, streets packed bumper to bumper with cars, no adults, kids revving their engines, playing hip-hop, sitting on car hoods, tossing crumpled up pieces of paper with phone numbers back and forth. Young girls with white bandages over their nose pretending that they had plastic surgery, some sort of status symbol.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't mean that when you engage them in conversation about whether Iran should have nuclear capability, they were going to agree with you. They were fiercely protective of their country's right to have nuclear weapons.
Young people in Iran lump nuclear energy and nuclear weapons together in the same category of advancement for Iran. They support the idea of nuclear weapons and nuclear energy, not because they support the regime, but because they claim to support Iran. Now, the reality is, while that's a priority, young people in Iran told me that, you know, much higher priorities are the bad economy, the lack of access to basic health care, the lack of infrastructure, the pollution, crime, rampant drug use, all of these issues. And what young people in Iran haven't necessarily been given is the opportunity cost of the nuclear program. Their regime is spending, you know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars on a nuclear program. Those are hundreds of millions of dollars that aren't being spent on their higher priorities.
Well, let's move to Lebanon with that in mind, because you meet, again, a lot of partiers, a lot of partying going on late at night. You call it democracy after dark in some of these countries. But you also met with kids in a Palestinian refugee camp. You also met with members of Hezbollah, young militants. What happened when you told these people that you were Jewish?
You know, I was at a McDonald's with a group of Hezbollah members, and I had been interviewing them and others for a couple weeks, and they wanted me to go into some of the Hezbollah strongholds to interview some of the youth leadership. And I hadn't told them I was Jewish, but they needed a copy of my passport. When I finally did tell them at McDonald's, their response was, "We don't care that you're Jewish or American. We hate the American government and we hate the Israeli government, but Jewish people and American people have done nothing to us." I'm not really comfortable with that answer, but it's just interesting that they distinguish between governments, people, and religion, because most of them don't like their own governments, and most of them recognize that, you know, the 0.001% of their own religion that is supporting Al-Qaeda and groups like that is a very small, albeit well-advertised minority that doesn't necessarily characterize the rest of the religion.
Jared Cohen, as we said, traveled throughout the Middle East, and by the way, his friends in Hezbollah who found out he was Jewish later never returned his calls. He also found DVDs of seasons 1 and 3 of the show West Wing at a Virgin megastore in Beirut. Season number 2 had too many references to Israel, he was told. In Syria, he met kids who loved their country but had to leave to get a college education because they felt the world wouldn't accept a degree from Syria. We're going to hear so much more from Jared after a break. And later in the program, the controversy over the film The Golden Compass will have that as well. Some Catholics calling for a boycott. We'll meet a theologian who says no. Back in a minute, here and now.
There is a world where witches rule the northern skies, where ice bears are the bravest of warriors.
The trailer for the new film, The Golden Compass, promises a breathtaking fantasy adventure in a magical world where a young girl named Lyra tries to rescue a friend from the Magisterium, a mysterious group that steals children and takes them to a hidden laboratory for experiments. The film is based on the first book of the best-selling and highly acclaimed trilogy called His Dark Materials by British author Philip Pullman. But Pullman has also been called the most dangerous man in Britain, and here in the U.S., the Catholic League is calling for a boycott of the film, saying it will introduce children to the wonders of atheism and the damnation of Catholicism. What's going on here? Well, joining us is Donna Freitas. She's visiting assistant professor of religion at Boston University and the author of Killing the Imposter God, Philip Pullman's Spiritual Imagination and His Dark Materials. She also wrote an op-ed piece in the Boston Globe about the fray over the film. Donna, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, you describe yourself as a Catholic theologian who's deeply in love with these books. But the title of your book hints at some of the controversy, you know, killing the imposter God. Because in the final battle in the books, God is killed. And the author, Philip Pullman, has declared he's an atheist. So don't other Catholics have the right to say that those are anti-religious if God is killed in the end?
Well, I'd like to be a little particular about the title. It's called Killing the Imposter God, and that's very intentional because in the last book, there is a death scene, but it's not the death of God, and I think most readers of Pullman's trilogy would quibble with the idea that God dies. The character who dies, Pullman calls the Authority with a capital A, and it's the first angel who tricked all other beings into believing that he was God who dies. And so I came to these books as a reader looking for great literature almost a decade ago now. I had this incredible reaction to it, and I saw all this theology in it.
Even though the books are from an atheist.
Well, at the time, I didn't know anything about Pullman. I just read them as a story, and I found that they were pretty magical in terms of adventure, but also I found them filled with theology, and so I began with a friend of mine to think about all of that. And it doesn't worry me so much that Pullman is an atheist. What we called him in the book is a reluctant theologian.
Yeah, someone who may claim he's an atheist, but you see theology in his books. Well, you've interviewed Philip Pullman. Let's hear how he describes what his books are about.
I think the qualities that the book celebrates are those such as kindness and love and courage and courtesy, too, and intellectual curiosity, all these good things. And the qualities that the book attacks are cold-heartedness, tyranny, closed-mindedness, cruelty, the things that we all agree are bad things.
Does he say to you that he's attacking organized religion?
I think Pullman is concerned about abuse of authority, period. He's critiquing secrecy and those who have access to knowledge and who try to hoard it. And I think that that happens in organized religion. I think that that happens in government. I think it happens in many different spheres.
Well, in the books and the film, the magisterium, well, they're the bad guys, the authority that pursues the young girl Lyra and undertakes experiments on children. In the Catholic Church, we understand that magisterium describes the teaching authority of the Pope and the Church. Here's a scene in the film where Lyra, played by Dakota Blue Richards, confronts an icy magisterium employee, played by Nicole Kidman, asking her about the magisterium's purpose.
What's the magisterium for?
Oh, you have been living in an ivory tower, haven't you?
The magisterium is what people need. They keep things working by telling people what to do.
Donna Freitas, why shouldn't Catholics be insulted by the idea that someone would name this evil authority after the Catholic authority?
I think we need to remember that Pullman has built a world of fantasy here, and I think he's borrowing words in all sorts of ways and reforming them. But I think the great irony in all of this is all of these critics that are coming out from different Christian circles are so concerned with keeping everyone from these books. And what's odd is that in many ways they're doing the very thing that Pullman is critiquing in his books, which is keeping or trying to keep them secret, trying to keep people from whatever is so scary in the story. And so it's been odd to watch them acting like the magisterium in the trilogy.
Also in the film, and we heard a little bit in the background of that clip, there are these animal spirits that everyone in this world has as close to them as their own heart. They're called demons. What do you see in the demons?
Well, I see them as souls. I think it's Pullman's concept of the soul, and I think it is one of the most exquisite renderings of the soul I have encountered. The idea that we would be able to chat with our soul and play with it and hug it and discover what it's like is so beautiful and extraordinary. And so I love the way it helps me reimagine what the relationship with our soul could be like.
You see souls, you see actually sort of a feminine divine that gets revealed. And as you've said, you see theology throughout the books. Did you say that to Mr. Pullman? Did you call him on his calling himself an atheist? Do you think that, you know, maybe he's not?
The first question I asked him was, what do you think of the fact, you know, of being called a theologian? And he sort of chuckled, and then he said he wasn't used to it, but it really intrigued him. And he actually at one point had said, I think you might have to send me a reading list. And so what's interesting, I think, about what he's doing is he has this big battle scene at the end of the books, and this imposter god dies. But at the same time, I feel like really the arc of the trilogy is about revealing this other vision of the divine that is very Christian, very much rooted in feminine image of the divine, and also in liberation theology. And an image that's been around for ages, actually.
Of what? Of love, of kindness, of...
Oh, of a very particular vision of God that is what gives us life. It's what animates us. It loves us more than we could possibly imagine, that wants so badly a relationship with us, that wants to be revealed to us. And so I think in many ways it's a very traditional version of God, and one that a lot of theologians in the 20th century have been illuminating themselves.
That's Donna Freitas, a visiting assistant professor of religion at Boston University, speaking about the trilogy of books behind the new film, The Golden Compass. And just, have you seen the film? How do you think the film represents the books?
I did see the film, and I enjoyed it. I think it's a very exciting adventure. All of the major concepts that Pullman unpacks in that first book are there. And I know there's been a lot of concern that the film has been watered down, but just like in the books, Pullman, you know, he throws out all these concepts and they're revealed in the story, but he doesn't tell you what to make of them. And it would be very strange if the producers had decided what they were for us, too. It's our job to think about that.
Donna, thanks so much.
Thank you.
President Bush's campaign to push Congress to pass legislation got sidetracked yesterday by questions about his Iran policy after the new National Intelligence Estimate said Iran's nuclear weapons program was frozen back in 2003. But the president has still been calling on lawmakers to pass legislation on warrantless wiretapping, war funding, and the alternative minimum tax. Congress only has 3 weeks to go before the holiday recess, and it's also grappling with energy policy and a slew of spending bills. Joining us with an update on Congress, Jonathan Allen of the Congressional Quarterly. And Jonathan, first of all, are legislators feeling pressure from the president? He's calling them a do-nothing Congress. Or are Democrats in particular feeling their oats today, you know, after yesterday's revelations from the new NIE? You know, have they switched to a discussion of Iran?
I think both statements are true. I think the Democrats are feeling some crunch to get some legislation passed, get some things enacted, to avoid the do-nothing label. It's a powerful tool in politics to call Congress a do-nothing Congress, as the Democrats found in calling Republicans a do-nothing Congress in the last election cycle. And so I think they want to have a few more things on their victory list, so to speak, as they head into an election year next year.
Well, let's start with some of the things on the agenda. The energy bill, we've spoken of this. It calls for raising fuel economy standards by 40%, sort of on an average of the nation's fleet for cars and light trucks by 2020. And it also includes $21 billion in tax incentives that could be offset by repealing, you know, oil and gas industry incentives. The White House has threatened to veto. Is that standoff still pretty much the same?
I think that standoff is pretty much the same. Among other things, the White House really doesn't like the $21 billion in subsidies for oil and gas industry being repealed by the bill. And of course, there's some opposition in the Senate too, particularly from Southern senators to the renewable electricity mandate. And so there are a lot of obstacles still remaining for this bill. It's likely to get passed in the House this week, but where it goes from that is unclear at this point.
Well, Democrats and Republicans and the White House haggling over war spending. The president wants a bill that doesn't include timetables for withdrawal or restrictions on troops. Democrats want both. The president says that at the rate we're going, the troops will not get their funding. The troops themselves won't be supported. The Democrats say that will never happen. What is true there?
Well, this is a debate that happens between president and the Congress, no matter who's in charge of Congress. As long as this war has been going on, the president has said that the Pentagon needs its funding for the war a little quicker than Congress generally thinks it needs it. There is some ability of the Pentagon to shift money around in accounts and provide funding for the ongoing efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan. When that ability runs out, when the funds to shift run out, is really a question for bean counters, and they even disagree sometimes on when it will run out. I think the answer the Democrats give, that they're not actually going to let the funding expire, is probably accurate. There would be a political catastrophe for Democrats if, in fact, troops in the field were not getting funding for the weapons that they needed or their armor.
I want to take a second to make sure we touch on the alternative minimum tax. This is the measure that was created in 1969 to prevent a small number, something like 100 families, wealthy families, from avoiding taxes. Now it wasn't updated for inflation, and it's going to hit thousands of middle-income families. And the IRS is saying, look, if you don't pass something soon, we need weeks just to get the paperwork together for April tax time. What's going to happen here?
Well, you know, the problem here is, and as you mentioned, there wasn't a lot of foresight when this was written to not index it to inflation. It captures a lot of people, and the problem that the Democrats are having is that particularly with the rules that they've tried to follow, pay-as-you-go budgeting rules, which basically means if you cut taxes, you have to find something to pay for that, or if you
right.
have spending, you find a way to raise taxes. And so Democrats have been trying to adhere to that this year. If you fix the AMT, it costs a lot of money to do that. So where is the money going to come from? There are some in the House of Representatives who want to see an increase in taxes for managers of private equity funds. There are some other ideas that have been thrown out there in the House. Those aren't as acceptable in the Senate. And so there's
a
clash going on.
And they join all the ideas that seem to be thrown around. Nothing landing quite yet. That's Jonathan Allen of Congressional Quarterly with a catch-up. Jonathan, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
And we'll just keep an eye on it, see if anything's wrapped up before the holidays. You're listening to Here and Now.
Baker's Hotline, this is Mary Jane.
Since 1994, Bakers in a Pinch have been calling the Bakers Hotline at the Vermont-based King Arthur Flour. As we discovered when we spoke to them last year, the 200-year-old employee-owned company fields about 60,000 calls and emails a year about a variety of questions. Since we are between holiday baking seasons, we thought we'd revisit the conversation we had with Robin Sargent, who helped launch the hotline, and we began by asking her what kind of calls she gets.
We frequently, and especially now, I think more and more people are aware of the benefits of whole grains and eating healthy. So we're getting a lot of questions now, how can I substitute whole wheat for all-purpose flour in a recipe?
How would you answer that?
In general, you can really usually do an equal substitution. You can use whole wheat for all-purpose one-for-one if you really want to go grainy. You will find, however, that your doughs and your batters are thirstier because whole grain flour tends to absorb more liquids.
Mm-hmm.
So you usually have to adapt by adding a little bit more liquid, whether that be milk or water, whatever you're using for a liquid. I recommend instead doing more like a 50%.
Well, we have a few of the other emails that have been sent to the Baker's Hotline recently. Here are some of the questions. Your flour says it has no bromates. What are bromates?
Right. Actually, potassium bromate is an additive that was more commonly added in the past. Nowadays, we don't see it so much. But it's a chemical additive that artificially strengthens the flour so it performs better in baking. And you really don't have to add that chemical. We've never added that chemical here at King Arthur Flour. But the chemical was found to cause cancer in laboratory mice. So there are now labeling laws against its use.
Huh.
Again, it just sort of artificially strengthened flour so it performed better, something that flour will do well if you just age it naturally.
Well, in fact, speaking of using flour, what is your best recommendation for, let's just say, rolling out a crust? Do you recommend balling it up and putting it in the fridge prior?
Well, the balling thing is really common. A lot of people will take their dough and they'll make a ball with it. And you know what happens when you do that is it's really hard to roll it out once it's chilled because the center of this ball is still kind of warm and the outside is very cold.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as you set it down and put your pin on top of it, it cleaves into two pieces. So it's smarter to shape it into a ball and then press it down into a disc and then wrap it in plastic, and it rolls out really well.
And do put it in the fridge, though, once you've done that.
Definitely.
And chill it. Okay.
All right. You want to keep it cold for about 15 to 30 minutes or so at least.
So that explains all my cleaved balls of dough. Okay, a couple other questions that you've gotten. Which cake pan will last forever? And I am curious, what do you recommend? Do you recommend glass or the old-fashioned kind of tinny one?
You know, I really am a fan of a high-grade aluminum pan for baking, and that's what I tend to use now. And I've had them for years. And these are shinier than they are dark. A lot of the new pans are anodized and they're dark. I find that my cakes tend to get dark too quickly in those pans because the heat is attracted to that dark color and it holds the heat. The shiny pans reflect the heat away, so you get a much more even color on your cake, which is nice.
Well, it's funny you mentioned anodized pans, and I understand you have a degree in science and are very attuned to how much science there is in baking.
I think it's fascinating. I really do. When you're baking bread and the recipe calls for salt, a lot of people don't realize that salt isn't just in there for flavor, although that's a pretty critical reason to add salt to bread. Have you ever had that salt-free bread? Yuck. Mm. I know they make it in Tuscany. They don't add salt, but think about what they're putting on it, right? Parmigiano, Reggiano. And
right, because otherwise it's kind of cardboardy or something.
Yeah, real flat tasting. But aside from just flavoring bread, salt actually tightens the gluten, which is something that's in wheat flour that creates kind of a stretchy network that traps the carbon dioxide that the yeast is making. So without it, you would have a much looser dough. And on top of that, it helps control fermentation. Without salt, the yeast tends to produce a lot of carbon dioxide, and it kind of gets out of control. And then pretty soon your bread can start to look like a chef's hat on the top. It starts to rise up and then collapse a little bit. So the salt prevents that. So it's an important ingredient for scientific reasons as well as flavor.
Staying on the topic of yeast, you had a cri for help from Japan. What was that?
Oh, that was really one of the funniest questions I ever fielded on the hotline. A woman called. She had been in the country, and she had purchased some products from us, and she called because she was having a problem with her dough. She was making bread, and the bread dough was in a bowl. She had it in her oven with just the oven light on, which is a great place to keep your dough safe and warm without cooking it. But the dough was starting to ooze out of the sides of the oven, and it was dripping down onto the floor, and it was a colossal mess. And she was a little upset, and she was trying to figure out what was going on, and we talked about the recipe, and everything seemed fine, and then we talked about the yeast, and I asked her how much she had used, and she used a package, she said. Well, she bought her package of yeast from us, and we sell it in one-pound packages. So she had put a pound of yeast into her dough.
As opposed to a couple tablespoons.
Or two teaspoons
whatever,
right?
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's fun. Some are, you know, actually quite poignant, though. I'm thinking of one we have here. You got a letter from Mary asking if you had an idea for a cake that would keep for greater than a week because her husband is in Iraq. And it takes about a week to get things to him. And she added, he doesn't eat nuts.
Isn't that sweet?
Yeah, what did you recommend?
Well, we recommend most cakes have a pretty good shelf life, but you want something that will probably be enhanced by time. And I think a gingerbread or a pound cake, anything very rich in butter and sugar, is going to keep pretty well on its way overseas, maybe even improve with age. Certainly fruitcake does, right?
If you ever eat it.
He doesn't like nuts, so I don't think that her husband would want fruitcake.
Well, you also heard from an elderly gentleman who lost his wife, and she had made bread for him every day. And he wanted to make it now, too, you know, to carry on the tradition. And you talked him through some of that.
He was a very sweet man. He was in his 90s, and his wife had died, unfortunately. And she made him this bread every day of their married life. And they would have toast for breakfast and then a slice of bread or sandwiches for lunch. And then with dinner, their soup or stew, they'd have the rest of the loaf. And then she would start the bread that night, make a sponge, and then bake it off in the morning for breakfast. And after she died, he missed her so much, and he knew he couldn't bring her back, but he was bound and determined that he was going to eat that bread again. So he had never baked in his life, and he watched her a little bit, but we talked, and I think I got him going, and he said, well, I'm going to go out, and I'm going to buy everything I need, and tomorrow I'm going to call you, and you're going to help me through this. So I said, absolutely, I'll be there for you. So the next day, my phone rang, and he called, and he said he had been out, and he had had bought everything he needed in the recipe, but there was one ingredient he couldn't find. And he said, "Where do you buy scalded milk?" And I just loved that. I'm picturing in the supermarket half and half heavy cream buttermilk scalded milk.
Well, when baking is about more than, you know, just bread or pies, obviously, there's so much more behind it. Robin Sargent of King Arthur Flour, if you have a baking question, by the way, you can go to our website, here-now.org. We'll link to hers. And we just want to say, in the interest of full disclosure, we requested an interview with you. The fact that King Arthur then sent us a platter of sticky buns has nothing to do with our conversation today.
Well, you know, the easiest way into your heart is through the stomach, right?
Definitely, in this case. Robin, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
I'm baking a biscuit. He's wheeling through his skin. While I'm cooking breakfast for the one I love.
We hope these tips help you gear up for the big baking season ahead. Remember, warm ovens come from warm hearts.
While I'm cooking breakfast for the one I love, I serve a plate.
Yeah, but how do you turn it on? Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
The heck like hot meal, sprinkled meatloaf, to show that he's grateful.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.